From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! Radical African-American cartoonist Aaron Magruder sees his comic strip pulled from newspapers across the country. An educator at the U.S. Institute for Peace suggests the U.S. should do some soul-searching and not retaliate with military force. She's forced to resign. A guide at a small museum in Texas gives the FBI a special tour of an exhibit on America's covert wars. The Secret Service pays a visit to a college freshman for having an anti-Bush poster in her room. Just a few examples of the new McCarthyism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House told Congress in a letter released yesterday that Vice President Dick Cheney, or his aides, met six times last year with representatives of the recently bankrupt Enron Corporation. One of the meetings occurred just 6 days before Enron announced actions that reduced its shareholder equity by $1.2 billion. The letter was written in response to a December 4th request by Congressman Henry Waxman, the ranking minority member of the House Committee on Government Reform. Waxman released the correspondence. The United Nations yesterday criticized the U.S. for blocking billions of dollars of humanitarian contracts bound for Iraq, expressing what it called grave concern at the unprecedented surge in volume of holds placed on contracts. In a move that's likely to frustrate Washington, the U.N. announced it would next week send Benon Savan, the executive director of its Iraq program, to Iraq to assess the massive humanitarian project and the impact of the U.S. policy. U.S. sanctions against Iraq are estimated to have killed up to 1 million civilians. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down a unanimous ruling yesterday narrowing the scope of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Under the ruling, a person can qualify for protection by the act only if he or she has substantial limitations on abilities that are, quote, central to daily life and not only to life in the workplace. California Governor Gray Davis wants to give state and local police broad new powers to obtain wiretaps and monitor email. The proposal is sparking outrage from civil liberties groups and may set up a showdown with members of his own party in the legislature. This from Utah. A man who tried to set fire to a Pakistani-American family's business 2 days after the September 11th attacks was sentenced yesterday to more than 4 years in prison. Federal prosecutors said the arsonist, James Herrick, made the restaurant curry in a hurry, his target because of the owner's race. In San Diego, meanwhile, a man who attacked a Middle Eastern service station clerk with a screwdriver on November 18th was sentenced to 6 years in prison. The Vatican has issued new rules saying it will use secret ecclesiastical courts to try priests accused of sexually abusing children and will oversee the cases directly from Rome. The rules were issued quietly, and one Vatican official said they're intended to, quote, protect the rights of the accused. But critics say the rules could instead add to the impression that the Roman Catholic Church is trying to conceal abuses rather than address the pastoral needs of victims. A 27-year-old Turkish woman has died, bringing the death toll to 46 in hunger strikes by activists protesting prison conditions in Turkey. She was the third hunger striker to die this year. The strikers began their campaign more than a year ago. The government has refused to negotiate with them, saying they are terrorists. The numbers of those strikers who've died have ranged from 46 to more than 60. This news from Zambia. Hundreds of women marched through Lusaka to protest the recent election of President Levi Mwanawasa. The election was marred by charges of vote rigging. Several opposition party leaders have vowed a court challenge. A 230-year-old Ottoman fortress overlooking the Grand Mosque in Mecca has been demolished to make way for a construction project. King Fahd approved a $533 million project last month, calling for 11 high-rise apartment buildings and a luxury hotel. The plan also calls for reconstruction of the fortress, which was used to defend Mecca and the Grand Mosque against attacks from rebels. The demolition was carried out by the Saudi Bin Laden Group, the engineering conglomerate owned by Osama bin Laden's family. The United States Postal Service said yesterday it planned to raise the price of a first-class stamp to 37 cents in June and cut as many as 15,000 jobs this year as a result of the weak economy, the attacks of September 11th, and the discovery of anthrax in the mail system. This from the New York Times. The Bush administration is walking away from a $1.5 billion 8-year government-subsidized project to develop high-mileage gasoline-fueled vehicles. Instead, it's throwing its support behind a plan that the Energy Department and the auto industry have devised to develop hydrogen-based fuel cells to power the cars of the future. A federal judge in Montana has blocked a Bush administration decision that would have allowed logging on more than 40,000 acres of the Bitterroot National Forest. In his opinion, the judge took the administration and the Forest Service to task for issuing their decision administratively and avoiding the customary 45-day public appeals process. The move, he said, looked like an extra legal effort to circumvent the law. It was not immediately clear how the administration would respond. An tentative settlement was announced yesterday in a federal desegregation lawsuit against public schools in Yonkers, New York. The deal could end more than 20 years of bitter litigation and federal intervention in the state's fourth largest school district. It calls for the state to provide $300 million to the Yonkers School District in the next 5 years to pay for programs to improve the performance of African-American and Latino students. The NAACP and the Justice Department sued Yonkers and its Board of Education in 1980 over what they called racial segregation in the city's housing and its schools, where more than a third of the students are African-American or Latino, the state later included as a defendant. And President Bush signed a sweeping new education bill into law yesterday, vastly enlarging the role of the federal government in public education. The bill provides expanded funding for schools in exchange for annual testing of children in grades 3 to 8. It does not, however, include a voucher program favored by President Bush.
There are some of us who don't accept the dreams of dragons as their own, no matter how grand those dragons might say they are. Yes? There are some who will refuse to drop the candle even when pushed into a dark cave and locked there behind a stone. There is, you must recall, a kind of serious study that will give you the confidence to strike your match to the mighty wick that will illuminate yet another portion of the darkness.
The novel Sound from Lorca. Here on the War and Peace Report, this is Democracy Now!, still banned on Pacifica Station WBAI, but a very hearty hello to our new listeners back from 5 months in exile as we broadcast in KPFT Houston, WPFW in Washington, KPFK in Los Angeles, KPFA in Berkeley, and hello to Leonard Peltier and all the listeners to KKFI. It is wonderful to be back in Kansas City, and of course to our old friends, Pacifica affiliates and affiliates in exile around the country, and KFCF in Fresno. It is wonderful to be with you again, as we have been each day over these last years. Well, I'm looking at a cartoon. It shows a young African-American calling the FBI's anonymous terrorism tip line. He says, "I'm very serious. I know of several Americans who have helped train and finance Osama bin Laden." And the person at the other end of the phone says, "How did you come to buy this information? A little investigating. It wasn't that hard, actually. Okay, give me some names." "All right, let's see. The first one is Reagan." That's R-E-A-G. "Hello? Hello?" That's the end of that comic strip. Let me go to the next one. Huey squeals to the Fed's terrorism hotline. "Why did you keep hanging up on me? I'm telling the truth. The CIA trained Osama bin Laden in using terrorism against the Soviets during the Reagan-Bush administration. They gave the Afghanistan rebels countless amounts of covert funding. Don't you have better things to be doing? Better than fighting terrorism? Heck no, we're at war." Well, this is just two of the comic strips by the well-known radical cartoonist Aaron Magruder. His work runs in some 250 publications across the United States, but in the new climate of intolerance for dissent or even debate, many newspapers have dropped the strip. The New York Daily News dropped the strip for about a month and a half. Right now, the editor makes day-to-day decisions on whether to run the strip, depending on its content. Newsday in Long Island chose not to run the September 11th-inspired strips the first week they appeared. The Dallas Morning News has moved the strip to a separate section altogether from other comics. Aaron Magruder responded to the censorship on October 17th when he ran a strip that began with an official-looking editor's note. It reads, "Due to the inappropriate political content of this feature in recent weeks, it is being replaced by The Adventures of Flaggy and Ribbon, which we hope will help children understand the complexities of current events. United we stand." For the next few days, the patriotic characters explain that terrorism is caused by people who hate our freedom of speech. They railed against radical hippie communists who dare to raise the issue of civilian casualties in Afghanistan, and they urge people to fight terrorism by spending money. For the next two segments, we're going to talk to a number of people who've experienced the new McCarthyism. But right now, we go to Los Angeles and are joined by the cartoonist, Aaron Magruder. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
So tell us how long your comic strip has been around.
The strip launched April 19th, 1999, in about 160 newspapers across the country. And that was where most people saw it. It had a brief life on the internet and in my university paper before that and in the Source magazine. But 1999 was the big launch.
Why don't you introduce your characters to us of Boondocks?
Well, very briefly, the strip essentially centers around two or three young black kids. The first would be Huey Freeman, who's a radical socialist, his younger brother Riley, who's sort of a wannabe thug, his best friend Caesar, who's just sort of a laid-back kid from Brooklyn who sort of co-signs what Huey says as a much lighter point of view. And then there are Huey and Riley's granddad, Tom and Sarah Dubois, the interracial couple down the street, Jasmine, their daughter, some of the characters at school, but that's essentially the strip.
So, Huey, after September 11th, what happened to him around the country?
Well, you know, Huey ended up staying Huey, which, obviously was not easy for some people to deal with. But I think many people were pleased that the tone of the strip did not change, and that I didn't back away from the events as would have been very easy to do.
And the newspapers, how does it work? You sell Boondocks to the syndicate
I'm partnered with Universal Press Syndicate that distributes the strip, edits the strip, bills the clients. That you know, they do everything. I have no time or desire to do. And so when I do a week of strips, I send the strips in to them. They read them over, they edit, they clean up, and then they distribute them to the client newspapers, which is like 250. And they act as a liaison between, you know, myself and the newspaper. So I rarely talk with the newspapers directly, if ever. It all goes through my editors at Universal Press, who have been absolutely amazing during this time in terms of their support. As you know, many people may or may not know, Universal Press has distributed Gary Trudeau for a few decades now. So they're accustomed to this type of controversy. They like this type of political content, and they've never once asked me to change anything in the strip.
How does it affect you when, say, the Daily News? Was that the longest you were removed from a paper? This is the Daily News in New York.
That was, but it's important to remember that I am removed fairly often from newspapers around the country for various reasons. So it's not sort of, it wasn't an unprecedented thing. It was longer than any other major paper had removed me. But in terms of how it affected me, I mean, the truth is it's really made the strip much more popular than it was before September 11th because of all the additional exposure. You know, I mean, they banned the strip at a time when people were talking about these censorship issues. So it really became a story. I ended up on Nightline. I mean, it's been, you know, it's a full-page story in Entertainment Weekly. It's just been really interesting to see the response from this, but it's been overwhelmingly, to me personally, much more positive than negative, which makes me quite lucky considering what's happening to some other people.
We're talking to the creator of Boondocks, Aaron Magruder, in Los Angeles. I'm looking at the strips, well, a couple weeks after 9-1-1, and you've got Huey watching television, and the TV is saying, "We'd like to take this time to remind all Americans in this time of hardship and sadness that Channel 33 News' ongoing coverage of America Strikes Back is brought to you by Nike, who would like to remind all freedom-loving, brave American soldiers to just do it, and by McDonald's." And then the next one, it says, you've got, "Isn't it interesting how all the different news channels have cool titles and logos for their coverage? It's almost like watching a miniseries. Let's see, Channel 2 is America's Vengeance, Channel 12 is America at War, and Channel 33 is America Strikes Back. How about America stops and thinks about why some people hate us?" It doesn't quite lend itself to a John Williams-style theme song, does it?
No, and what's interesting is that those titles were all made up probably 7 days after the attack. Those strips were written about 7 days after the attack, which was before we started bombing Afghanistan and before we actually found out that the networks would call it America Strikes Back.
What about your Thanksgiving comic strip, Osama bin Laden and Bush?
I got that from an email forward that went around. When you do strips every day, you have no shame of stealing jokes. There was an email joke that went around that was laying out the similarities between Osama bin Laden and our leadership here, and I threw it in the Thanksgiving Day strip because it just seemed to fit so perfectly, and it was such a, you know, such a wonderful thing to sort of to spark the brain in terms of, you know, even a guy like me who thinks about this stuff a lot had never made all those connections as to how similar they were in terms of both being from wealthy oil families and all that stuff. So, the strip, as I recall, has Huey saying grace and being thankful that our leadership doesn't do these awful things like bomb innocent people and operate through covert organizations and circumvent the democratic process. And Bush is never his name is never said in the strip. It's sort of left for the reader to put together. I have gotten quite a bit of response from that one.
11:22. By the way, we air this on public access stations on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV. So we're showing the cartoons as well as community radio around the country.
Okay.
So you've got Huey, and he's saying grace. In this time of war against Osama bin Laden and the oppressive Taliban regime, we are thankful that our leader isn't the spoiled son of a powerful politician from a wealthy oil family who is supported by religious fundamentalists, operates through clandestine organizations, has no respect for the democratic electoral process, bombs innocence, and uses war to deny people their civil liberties. Amen. Then grandpa, his grandfather.
This is the last day. This is the last time you say great. Something like that. Yeah.
So, what keeps you going, and do you think you're going to stay here doing this?
Two very interesting questions. Obviously, I've kept going by a combination of my desire to have a voice to say the right thing and the desire to pay my rent. And both of those things are very important. How long will the strip run is a whole other question. It's a very demanding job in terms of having to come up with 7 strips a week every week, every, no vacation, forever. And And I look at people like Gary Trudeau, who've done this for decades, and I'm just sort of awed by them and their ability to keep going. To me, I can't say whether the strip's going to go for 5 more years or 10 more years or 3 more years. I kind of am at a point where I take it week by week, but I do have to say that I do think September 11th and what's happened since has I think it's rejuvenated the strip in a big way and given me I think a greater sense of purpose for what I do.
Huey is named for Huey P. Newton?
Yes.
And how do you actually work in a day as a cartoonist? First of all, what do you watch? What do you read? Where do you write? Where do you draw?
All that stuff, except for where I write and draw, kind of changes. I mean, in terms of what I watch and what I read, I mean, I will go through sort of very long periods of sort of submerging myself in the news and then, like most people, just get sick of it and then stay away from it for a couple of weeks. I work out of my apartment here in Los Angeles. I do the strip here. I've got a few other projects going on. So you know what happens is most of the week I'm working on them, and then the seven strips that I have to do generally get done over a 2-day period, one for the Sunday and one for the Monday through Saturday strips. Those end up being very long nights.
9:28. You've got Huey watching television again, and this is the TV. Thanks, Peter. There's been a lot of talk recently about the country coming together. I'm here with Bob Carter. Now, Bob, you're a gay African-American environmentalist and former critic of the president. Former critic, yes. Now I realize that America is all about blind, unquestioning faith in our almost elected leaders. Amen to that, Bob, and God bless America. Back to you, Peter. One of the interviews.
You know, hearing them now, they're a bit heavy-handed, but these were all written, the ones that you just read. Those were written September 17th or 18th, and then it took another additional week for them to actually hit newspapers. I had literally just spent 5 days watching the news after the attacks happened, trying to figure out if I would even have a job after this. So, it is what it is. I was.
Activists after September 11th dealing with, the terror of what had taken place, but then wondering what place there was for dissent and for revving up as the administration was revving up for war?
Absolutely. No, that was an incredibly difficult decision as to how early to address the attacks and in what way, can you make jokes about it without appearing insensitive to the people who lost their lives or had loved ones that were dead. It was a very, very difficult moment, and I think at the end of the day, it was the right thing to do. If for no other reason than nobody else was going to do it, even Trudeau waited a few weeks before he started talking about it. But I think certain things needed to be said right away. And just a few short days after the attacks, the country was moving in a very dangerous direction, and somebody had to address it. And I was glad that I had the medium in place to do that.
Well, I thank you very much for doing your comic strip, for doing Boondocks, which is serious, funny, extremely creative, and needs to be there. So, folks, remember that media activism really does work. And when you miss a Boondocks strip, call up and find out why. Why wasn't it in your local newspaper? Aaron McGreer.
It really does, too. If people call, a couple dozen calls makes a big difference in the newspaper.
Oh, huge. I know it from... our own experience also just with Democracy Now. It's great to be back on in Los Angeles. In New York, we've yet to be put back on our home station, WBAI. The general manager, Bob Daughtry, listens to each program now and decides whether to put us on. And up to this point, he has yet to put on one of the programs.
Yet, huh? What
so
are you
we're
do?
Hoping. Maybe, Aaron, you'll help break the sound barrier for us.
I doubt it, but...
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report. That was Aaron Magruder. He's the creator of Boondocks. Go read it, watch it, look at it, and call in and celebrate it. Let the editors know, whether you agree or not with everything you read, that there has to be a place that is opened up for dissent in this country, that that's what it means to be patriotic. Stay with us as we talk about the new McCarthyism.
Set out to do. Stand. There's a cross for you to bear. Things to go through if you're going anywhere. Stand for the things you know are right. It's the truth that the truth makes them so alive. Stand. All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Stand, Sly and the Family Stone here on the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. I'm looking at the Progressive magazine, an article called The New McCarthyism by Matthew Rothschild. It starts, Dana Huanca works as a docent at the Art Car Museum, an avant-garde gallery in Houston. Around 10:30 on the morning of November 7th, before she opened the museum, two men wearing suits and carrying leather portfolios came to her door. I told them to wait until we opened at 11 o'clock, she recalls. Then they pulled out their badges. The two men were Terrence Donahue of the FBI and Stephen Smith of the Secret Service. But let's let Dana Huanca tell the rest of the story. She joins us now from Houston, Texas. Dana, it's good to have you with us.
Hi, good to have you.
So tell us what happened that day.
They had came in earlier than usual, and they were had suits on. They looked very. They didn't look like the typical art crowd, and I knew there was something wrong with them. But they just came in and said that they had some reports of anti-American activity, and I had. Express to them, well, what is anti-American about freedom of speech? And they were like, oh, you're going in way over your head here. We just got some reports, and we just want to look around briefly. And so I felt it was my duty to give them a tour because they weren't art critics, or how could they understand what art is supposed to do at a time like this, especially. And they were very interested in... looking at certain pieces and pointing out what it meant, and they weren't really understanding what the point was. I believe what had happened is we have the show was initiated in July of this year before the World Trade Center attacks, and we had opened it September 21st, which is 10 days after the attacks, and we had some direct pieces in there that by local artist Tim Glover, who had a drawing of George Bush Jr. with a trellis over him. It's a sculpture, basically an environmental statement, but it wasn't. And a lot of his other pieces are done during the Gulf War era. A lot of the pieces were done during that era, which is following with the themes of secret wars, which is government secrets, different kind of secrets within families and just different types of war was our themes, because we already have that agenda as an alternative space that is privately funded. We want to seek out progressive issues and different kinds of ways to make people think in our community. So
the overall exhibit was called Secret Wars?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it was curated in July. All the artists were gathered in that time. But we did have, you know, like some pieces were done during 92, during the Gulf War era, and it was, it had, like, we have a piece that's an oil flag. It's the American flag, which each stripe is motor oil and sand. And it's just we have a piece with the George Bush Sr. in the belly of the devil in one of the pieces, which was done in that time. But just things, the certain things that hit nerves now that everybody's hyper-patriotic and feels that everything's a threat and terrorism. And
I understand one of the installations in the exhibit is a surveillance camera.
Yeah, it was it's a mock surveillance camera that we had. And basically it was facing towards the door. And so you could see people coming in and out looking in the main gallery at the museum. Because we have a surveillance camera at the desk to see, make sure no one's touching the art and such. But they were interested in knowing if they were being surveillanced or not from that piece. And we don't record it. It's just like a mock surveillance.
And how long did the two gentlemen stay?
They were there for about an hour, a total of an hour. I tried to give them a full tour and try to actually kept them there longer than they, I guess, wanted to. I was just explaining to them we have a lot of text on the walls that go along with the work, like Chomsky and Robert Fisk and all different types of them.
It sounds like it's a visual display of Democracy Now.
Yes, it does.
Now, at the end of the hour, I'm nervous to say that if they're listening, but at the end of the hour, did they talk to you personally about yourself?
Yes, they did. They were interested in asking me what I went to school, what I was doing. If they actually asked me if my parents knew that I worked there. And just kind of attacked different, I don't know. I mean, I knew that they weren't concerned about my well-being, so I felt I was scared at first, of course. And
did you call anyone at the museum?
Well, yeah, I had called the chief curator, Tex Kirshen, who I had called him probably halfway through their visit to tell him to come over here and to explain more to them, and they... He didn't get there on time. There, he had got there about 5 minutes after they left, but I was there alone the whole time with them. It was very frightening. It was a Secret Service agent and a FBI, part of the Joint Terrorist Task Force, John Ashcroft.
We're also joined on the phone by Matt Rothschild, who wrote the piece that starts with your story, Donna Huanca, at the Art Car Museum in Houston, Texas. It's good to have you with us, Matt.
Morning, Amy. We listen to you every day, and I'm glad you're prevailing in your campaign there.
Well, we hope so, and great shout out to all the listeners of WORT in Madison, Wisconsin. It's wonderful to be there. I guess you're there every day at 1 p.m. Matt, you called the FBI in Houston to ask about this visit that Donna Huanca had, taking around to FBI and Secret Service men around the art exhibit called Secret Wars.
Yeah, and the FBI guy, he was real nonchalant about it. He said, well, you know, we get calls. We get a lot of calls. And someone had made a call here saying there was some artwork or something there that might be threatening to the president. So we thought we might as well go take a look. And then he said the agents went there and they looked at it and it wasn't their cup of tea, but they didn't think it was of a threatening nature. So they just kind of let it go.
So what have you found as you look around the country in this post-911 world? Is it much different than before in terms of civil liberties?
Yeah, I think we're entering into a very chilly period now, and I was struck by the number of different incidents I was able to gather up of people who were either losing their jobs if they were in journalism, columnists who got fired, or people like Donna who were visited by the FBI or the Secret Service because they had anti-American or un-American things on their walls or in their exhibits. I mean, those words, un-American or anti-American, they've got to echo in our ears that, you know, this is coming back to an old era of repression, McCarthyism. And the more I looked around, the more I gathered other incidents, and the more scared I actually got. And I was at a protest here in Madison early on after the war started, and a student there said, you know, she was real scared. And I tried to reassure her, oh, it's not so bad. And then the more I looked at it, the more I thought she probably was right.
Well, Matt, we have some of the people whose stories you profiled in the piece, The New McCarthyism, like A.J. Brown. A.J., you're a freshman at Durham Technical School in North Carolina. Can you talk about a visit that someone paid to you?
Yes. I got a visit by two Secret Service agents and a Durham special investigator on October 26th around 5 o'clock.
And where did they come to?
They came to my apartment. They knocked on my door, and they introduced themselves as Secret Service agents, and, again, one from the Durham Police Department. And they basically asked if I had any anti-American material in my apartment, and I was like, no.
They showed you their badges?
Yes.
Did they say they had reports of something?
Yeah, they said that they had gotten a report that someone called them and said that I had a poster of Bush hanging himself or Bush with a target on his head, which was not the case.
So what did you tell them?
I told them that I did not have that sort of thing, but I did have a poster, and they asked if they could look at it. And I asked them if they had a warrant. They did not have a warrant, so I told them, then you are not coming into my apartment. And they just basically kept talking to me. It lasted about 40 minutes. They tried talking me into letting them come into my apartment, but I didn't let them. I ended up calling my mom.
And what did she say?
She said to absolutely do not let them in. So I didn't, but I came to a compromise with Paul Lally, which was one of the Secret Service agents. He came up with this great idea about opening my door and letting them see it but not come into my house. And I said to myself, well, they might come back with a warrant, and I don't want them searching through all my stuff. Like, the computer that I have isn't even mine. So I went with the idea, and they got to see the poster, which says, "We hang on your every word. George Bush wanted 152 dead," and it does not have Bush hanging himself. It has Bush holding a rope, and it implies that he's hanging people. So, and it was from the anti-inauguration, dealing with how many people got killed in the prison system when he was governor.
Well, A.J. Brown, I want to thank you for being with us. Did they ask you to explain the poster?
No, but they kept gawking at it, so I went ahead anyway. But really, what got to me was when they asked me if I had any pro-Taliban stuff or maps of Afghanistan. I was like, what? You know, I was like, no, I don't. And it was just really intimidating.
Do you know why they came to your apartment at this point? Did you ask around to see if anyone had been talking to anyone about you?
No, I really didn't, because only, like, my good friends really have been in my apartment, except there was an incident earlier in the week where police officers came to my door because of loud music. I didn't think of anything of it, but it had to either be maintenance or the police who called the Secret Service.
Well, I want to, again, thank you, A.J. Brown from Durham Technical School, North Carolina, head of Visit Pay Terabyte Secret Servicemen. Before we go to our break, we thought we'd play a clip of an interview we did a while ago. This is just a minute from that. Some of our listeners may remember. Others who are just listening knew this week. This is Katie Sierra, who is a high school student who was suspended for wearing a T-shirt which she had written on. She'd written this phrase: "When I saw the dead and dying Afghani children on TV, I felt a newly recovered sense of national security. God bless America." She and her mother are now suing the school. We got in touch with her. This is Katie Sierra.
I got cursed out by some boy in my class, and he was sent to the office for, like, disrupting class, and then, like, I think a period later, they called me to the office and suspended me. They didn't, like, I thought they were supposed to, I mean, I don't see a problem wearing the shirt, but even if they do see a problem, they should tell me at least to take it off, which they never did. I mean, they just told me I was suspended, you know, ridiculous, but.
Did they hurt you?
The students?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, 2 weeks after when, like, the newspapers got involved, and my principal, he said that I wanted, like, America to burn and Afghanistan to win and, you know, stuff like that, which wasn't true. And, I mean, he says it's not true now, but he won't, like, talk to the students about it. So they kind of are upset with me, I guess.
And school board members?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't like me very much. I went to speak at the school board meeting, and they told me that, you know, like, what the hell is wrong with a kid like that? And, you know, all kinds of things. And I'm in front of, like, 100 parents, and I thought I was going to pass out. But
so what about your teachers?
Well, I have one that kind of supports me, but, like, she can't say much because they've been told not to support me or talk to anyone or anything like that.
Katie Sierra, 15-year-old sophomore at Sissonville High School in West Virginia. On October 22nd, she told her principal she wanted to form an anarchist club. Well, before long and after wearing that T-shirt, she was suspended from the school. She was crying. She said, "I had never been in trouble before. How could he suspend me for something so ridiculous as that?" Quoted in also the New McCarthyism, the piece that Matt Rothschild has done in the Progressive magazine. And we'll be back with some more stories and people from around the country who got some, well, surprise visits. Guess who's coming to dinner? You're listening to War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. Give your hands to struggle, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on the War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we are looking at Matt Rothschild's piece. He's the editor of the Progressive magazine that's based in Madison, Wisconsin. His piece is called The New McCarthyism. Matt, maybe you can introduce to us Barbara Wien.
Yeah, interesting, because this is one of the reasons I got going on this story. Barbara Wien, I had heard a report on the internet that she was being eased out of her job, to put it gently. She worked at the U.S. Institutes of Peace, which is funded by Congress, was created about 8 or 9 years ago to promote the peaceful resolution of international conflict. And then I had heard that she was pressured to resign or was fired, so I wanted to get hold of her And finally, after I left some messages, she called me back and she told me her story, which was basically that on September 11th, after the bombings, at an official function, she was brave enough to say, man, I hope the United States doesn't retaliate militarily, and perhaps we ought to look at what cause, if any, the United States has in terrorism around the world.
Well, Matt, we actually have Barbara Wien on the line, so maybe she can pick up the story from there. Barbara Wien joining us from the Washington, D.C. area, longtime peace educator who worked at the U.S. Institute for Peace. Worked is the operative word here. Welcome, Barbara Wien.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you, Matt. I think you all are doing a tremendous service to our country in raising this kind of a program.
Well, thank you for joining us. So tell us what happened.
Well, without getting mired in a lot of the details, I did, as Matt portrayed, raise some critical questions and concerns, and it was the morning of September 11th at an official function. And I implored my nation not to resort to military retaliation to try and investigate who might have perpetrated such a horrendous act and try to bring them to the bar of justice through international law or a police investigation, worldwide investigation of what had happened. But I also did go on to say that I think we need to do a lot of soul searching in our country to examine how U.S. policies may have contributed to the emergence of terrorist violence. This so enraged my colleagues at the Institute that I was told I would never lead another training program again at the Institute and that I would be without portfolio in the department. I continued to try and debate and struggle with them around these questions and asked, you know, why is it that time and time again at a lot of the Institute programs and panels, the use of military force is seen as a very valid or acceptable policy response, but a more pacifist or nonviolent position is not seen as acceptable. And, you know, we had some very heated discussions. I was basically told by the management that it was time for me to go, that I did not fit into the culture there, that I was the most left-wing person they had ever met. And my response was, the last time I looked, that's not a crime in America, and that they, too, are extremely conservative in their views, but I would never try to drum them out of their job as a result.
Now, wait, let's just talk again about where you worked, the U.S. Institute for Peace.
Yeah, this is a congressionally funded agency, and may I just say that I care deeply about this agency. I worked long and hard to establish the agency. I've been very involved in the movement for peace studies in higher education. And many of the peace studies professors I work with across the country testified before Congress to establish this institute. And I guess I have felt a sense of betrayal because they have a very, very limited range of debate there. You're only allowed to raise questions within certain parameters. And they've told me that I went outside the conventional wisdom in Washington by raising questions about the sanctions on Iraq or the bombings of Yugoslavia or the bombings of the Sudan and of course, this most recent war. So they told me I didn't fit in. I was too nonconformist, and the staff is expected to uphold the war. The exact words were, we need to support the president. We're at war. We need to support the president. And I said, well, I am not at war with the Afghan people. And my fear is that we're going to kill a lot of innocent civilians. Shouldn't the role of this institute be to explore a whole range of alternative policy options beyond the use of force and really have a rigorous debate about what would be some of the nonviolent approaches? And believe me, I wanted to get rid of the Taliban as much as the next person, but not by killing innocents.
Matt Rothschild, you called the executive vice president of the United States Institute of Peace.
Yeah, I did. I tried to get their fair comment on it, and her name's Harriet Henkes, and she was pretty curt about this whole thing. First of all, she said she didn't want to talk about it. It's just a personnel thing, which I was getting from a lot of employers who had dismissed people. But I pressed her a little bit, and she all that she would say essentially was that Barbara submitted a letter of resignation on October 17th, and then she said she didn't have a comment. But then she did add a comment. She said, we would never make an individual staff member's personal views a litmus test for employment.
You follow the story of Barbara Wien, a longtime peace educator who did work at the U.S. Institute of Peace, by the story of the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. Can you talk about the letter they sent out to their members?
Yeah, this was amazing. A local bookseller here in Madison, a good, great radical bookstore called Rainbow Bookstore Cooperative, sent me a letter from their director, Marcia Rummel. She had gotten this letter from a group called the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. They'd sent a form letter to all their members, and basically it said, because of the anti-terrorism law that Bush signed, the federal government can access or grab the records in bookstores of who their customers are and what books they're selling to whom. And the letter said, furthermore, there's a gag rule that once the FBI or the government agent comes in and takes those, the bookseller can't tell anyone about it. And so what this foundation of booksellers said, you should call us up when it happens. Don't tell us that they've done it, but tell us that you need to talk to our counsel. So there's surveillance of who buys what books. That's legal now. And then the booksellers aren't able to talk about it even to their own foundation. And there's a question as to whether they can talk about it to their attorney if they're not supposed to tell anyone about it.
And then what about libraries?
Libraries are similarly impacted. We had an article in the Madison Capital Times a couple of weeks after my article came out, and they expanded it to libraries, saying libraries also are going to have to reveal what their customers are looking at.
A little while ago, we did an interview with Barry Rheingold, who is a retired PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric worker in San Francisco, who was paid a visit by the FBI for criticizing U.S. foreign policy at his gym in San Francisco. Let's take a listen to what happened to Barry.
Well, from what they said, that someone had reported that that you were discussing what happened on September 11th, the terrorist incidents, and your views on bin Laden and Bush and the politics of oil, something to that extent.
And were you talking about that at the gym?
Yeah, I was talking about it, and a lot of people were talking about it.
And what are your views on Bush, bin Laden, and the politics of oil?
My feeling is that, it was a terrible incident, you know, the terrorist thing, but I feel that the U.S. policy as far as imperialism is pretty terrible, from Vietnam up to Iraq, and I think that there's a deeper reason that the U.S. is over in Afghanistan or in Iraq. It's over oil. It's not about, what they say is that they're there because of, because bin Laden or Saddam Hussein are terrorists, but I think it's because of competition, for oil profits. And I mentioned that, and a lot of people, I think, at this point, believe this. They're swept up in this nationalism, and I think that's a very bad thing, because I see a lot of cutbacks, hundreds of thousands of people being laid off in this country, and I think, that's, it has to do with the system, the whole system is in crisis.
Again, that was Barry Rheingold. The FBI visited him at his apartment after he raised questions about U.S. foreign policy. I don't know if he was on the Stairmaster, if he was lifting weights or what. He went back to the gym and asked who had told on him or who had reported this to the FBI. We on Democracy Now! Recently played the piece that Jeremy Scahill did on Free Speech Radio News of State Department ads that went out and played the actual ads calling for people to call into an 800 number to let the FBI know about questionable people. Barbara Wien, let me ask you about how you feel about this as a peace educator who's set up curriculum for some 20 years.
How I feel about the whole new McCarthyism or explicit?
Just this, the kinds of things that we're describing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are very, very fearful and very afraid, and they're acting out of fear, and that is their primary motivation. I feel sorry for them that they don't welcome a broader range of debate. They really don't have to fear greater democratic dialogue. In fact, it would strengthen our country. And, we need contending points of view. We need to have an honest, open, national debate about what constitutes real security in this country. And I think by putting their head in the sand and, you know, rallying around the flag, they're doing American democracy a terrible disservice. We need to raise critical questions about arms exports. We are the largest arms exporter in the world. 40% of all international arms exports are coming out of the United States. We are selling a lot of torture devices overseas. We're supporting the Saudi government. We're supporting the Israeli military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. All of these things need to be aired. And it shouldn't make people fearful. It would be a tremendous cleansing of our national spirit. I'd like to see us get out there and wash the American flag. I am never one who would burn the American flag, but we need to wash the American flag of our sins and really...
Please.
Pardon?
No, go ahead.
And really, come to grips with our role in the world. We can be such a positive, powerful, wonderful voice and force for positive change. And we are in some parts of the world. Some of our programs and certainly our citizens going overseas and exchange programs and these kinds of things serve a wonderful purpose in this world. I care deeply about my country. I certainly care deeply about the vision and the values that we're supposed to be upholding. It's the hypocrisy that's so hard for people in other areas of the world to witness. We're supposed to stand for something, and in fact, in the final analysis, we don't. So I think if we were really honest with ourselves and really candid, we would try to come to grips with some of our record. And really look at, what is the role of oil in a lot of these places in the world?
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Barbara Wien, longtime peace educator, forced out of the U.S. Institute for Peace for raising the issue of peace there. Matt Rothschild, thanks for doing the piece in the Progressive magazine called The New McCarthyism. Folks, you can go to the Progressive website at theprogressive.org. You can also go to our website to get all information about Democracy Now! At democracynow.org, and it links you to all the different people that we spoke to. And speaking of dissidents, remember to be dissident may be the highest tribute in this country. To be dissident is to be patriotic. And that goes from the national level right down to our own organization. We're having a national board meeting of Pacifica, the first face-to-face meeting of the new listener-backed board. And that's in New York this weekend at the DoubleTree Hotel starting Friday night at 47th and Broadway, right in Times Square. And there are local board meetings. For example, Los Angeles KPFK Local Advisory Board meeting is this evening, Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Peace Center in Los Angeles, located at 8124 West 3rd Street. Remember, to be a dissident is also to love your station and to love your country. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. It's great to be back. That's mail@democracynow.org. in exile, unfortunately, from Pacifica Station WBAI, but on the rest of the stations, it's wonderful to be here. We are going out with Michael Franti, listener supported. Media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Michael, my
don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come.